She lived to be 56. My dad, the alcoholic, the gambling addict, the chronically depressed, the probably on the autism spectrum, et cetera, et cetera. He lived to be 79 and smoked 2 packs of unfiltered Camels a day. I want to talk about how I got here. And that's because I was kind of sheepish about it. And then I heard somebody at a meeting whom I admired say that her getting into Al-Anon had been the same. It was, I flirted with Al-Anon a lot longer, a pretty long time before I actually committed. My journey in recovery began 39 years ago. I went to treatment, and naturally, when they did the screening, they said, "Is there any alcoholism in your family?" And my very truthful answer was, "Only the men." All the men were alcoholics, because the cultural patterns up until my generation were, the men all became alcoholics. Not a few of them were gambling addicts too, but that's a whole other 12-step program. And the women got to self, everybody's depressed. The men and the women are both depressed. The men are drinking at it. The women are getting angry at the men. And that's how they self-medicate their depression. They may be feeling a little blue at having to hold everything together, but at least they get to resent the men. And you know, that can energize you. And it was certainly true of me. I mean, virtually all of the men in my family were alcoholics. And virtually all the women in my family married alcoholics because you know, the Velcro. When the women grew up, and it here's this guy that just reminds them so much of dear old dad. So the whole social aspect here I've always found kind of interesting, the socio-cultural aspect. I'm half German and half Irish. I was born and raised in St. Louis in the Midwest, and that's a real common combination in the St. Louis area, Irish and German. I ruefully reflect that what do you get if you're half German and half Irish? You get a person with Irish efficiency and German charm. And as I say, in the generations before mine, virtually all the men were alcoholic. Now, the form that it took differed. On the German side of the family, when the men got drunk, they got even more withdrawn and depressed and uncommunicative. And when the Irish guys got drunk, they got even more social and unreliable and et cetera. So I am the happy fruit of those particular cultural strains. They asked, is there alcoholism in your family? And I said, all the men. And so they thought correctly that I should, as soon as I got out of treatment, I ought to start going to AA because being a man in my family, I guess what I had, but that I should also start going to Al-Anon. And if I'd made a firm connection and stayed, I'd have 39 years in Al-Anon. But this is what happened. It didn't take that time around for the very good, and for a paradoxical reason. I didn't like AA very much, but I loved Al-Anon because I could go to Al-Anon meetings, and I thought the purpose of Al-Anon was for me to go into great detail about what a truly terrible father I had. And I could go on about this at great length. I was thinking the other day, a couple of years into recovery, I did a 4-step just on my father, nobody else, just my father. And I did a list of my resentments of my father. And it was 7 pages, single spaced of sentences. And if you thought I got that and was shocked at that I could have that many resentments, you'd be completely wrong. I was completely startled that it was only 7 pages. Up until that time, I would have thought it would be about as long as War and Peace and about as detailed. I loved going to meetings and talking about it. And an Al-Anon fairy godmother appeared one day at a meeting I'd been going to. And she brought me up short because I was bragging to the group. I didn't think of it as bragging, of course, that I had sent a real nasty letter to my dad. He'd sent me some money. And I thought, you've got a lot of nerve, you lousy, drunk, gambling addict. You know, keep your dirty money to yourself. So I sent it back to him with a profanity. And I thought, I shared this at the meeting as, aren't I a good little Al-Anon? I'm getting my own back. I'm straightening out this terrible alcoholic in my life. And as I say, an Al-Anon fairy godmother appeared and said, you know, you might want to rethink that. That doesn't necessarily sound like recovery. So naturally, I came to the only conclusion that made sense. I decided I didn't want to go to Al-Anon anymore if people were going to say harsh and unpleasant things like that to me. But as so often in recovery, this profoundly stupid choice I made, well, it ended up being a very smart choice because in recovery, God does for me what I cannot do for myself, that I'm way too dumb to do for myself. So what really needed to happen, I think, from the point of view of an adult, which I was not at that time, I was 37, but by no means an adult. This turned out to be a real good idea because it meant I could get firmly established in the other program. Because the real temptation with the talking about what a lousy alcoholic my father was to drift to the point where, well, he's a real alcoholic. What I've got is this mild little, I mean, you can barely call it alcoholism that I've got. I mean, it's so mild. Why don't I keep working on how awful he is and stop thinking about not drinking myself? And I thought that might not be a good idea. So I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I will focus on that program and come back to Al-Anon when I've made some progress, when I've done some growing. Well, a few years went by, and everything I've done is highly predictable. I only found that out later. 2 years into recovery, like a lot of people, I found that it was high time to start talking about my family and what had gone on there. So I got outside help with that. And that was very helpful. That's what I think I needed to do at that time. A few years after that, I also decided that at about 6 years, this sure seemed to be pretty common in among the folks I dealt with. At 2 years, you go into therapy about your family. 6 years, you go back to school and become a drug alcohol counselor. I did. And about the time that I was doing all this family stuff, thinking about going back to school, switching professions, this was about the height of the adult children boom. Around 1990. And I was reading the books and I was going to the meetings. So I thought, I'm going to go back to Al-Anon. Same thing happened. I really was not ready for Al-Anon at that point. Had you asked me at the time, Jim, we're so glad that you've gone back to Al-Anon. Why are you going back to Al-Anon? And I said, I'm going back to Al-Anon because I'm at that phase of my recovery where it's very important for me to help alcoholics, and I need to give them really good advice to shape them in recovery. In fact, I'm thinking seriously about going back to school and getting a certificate. And Al-Anon would be just the place where I could go to give people advice. Well, what happened? This is about 1988, 1989. Another Al-Anon fairy godmother appeared at an Al-Anon meeting and caught me in the act of handing out advice. After each person spoke, I think I was chairing that night, and after each of them finished, I would suggest what they could do. And She said, you know, we actually don't do that in Al-Anon. We don't give advice. And the same thing as happened at first. When I got up against that, I thought, well, if that's how you're going to treat me in Al-Anon. So I went back out again. And over the years, I kind of flirted with it. I'd go to a meeting once in a great while and read a little Al-Anon this and a little Al-Anon that. I finally went to Al-Anon to stay. I finally decided that I was going to stop dating and actually make a long-term commitment. What brought me to Al-Anon? I went to Al-Anon because I had to. Up until that time, I had thought I should go to Al-Anon because it would be a nice merit badge on my sash. Yes, I've gone to Al-Anon and I, you know, I'm a thoroughly recovered blah, blah, blah. But when I finally went to Al-Anon for keeps, I went because I had to. I didn't think I had any other alternative. What had happened by then, and by now I've been in recovery for like 20 years, 20, 25 years. Why did I go to Al-Anon this time? Well, I'd gotten a job where my profession, I am in a helping profession. I was speaking at a meeting one night, a big speakers meeting in Portland, Oregon, as it happens. And I said, when I'm doing my job, I wear a particular set of clothes, but I don't wear them when I'm in a 12-step context because they might make people uncomfortable. So I just dress like a regular person at meetings. And after the meeting was over, two young women came up to me and kind of blushing and giggling. And one of them said, we were trying to figure out all through the rest of the meeting what it is that you do. So, you know, you don't have to, we understand that you didn't want to do this from the podium, but we figured, can we ask you, are you a gynecologist? And I'm not a gynecologist. And my sponsor, my Portland sponsor, Harry's wife, later in the evening sassed me for some reason, to at which Harry turned to her and said, that's no way to talk to a gynecologist. No, the fact is that from a pretty early age, I've been a clergy person. That's how I first came to the Bay Area, was to go to school where I got prepared for this. That's why I live with the notorious Tom W. We run a lot of the same rackets. And it's interesting. I don't know if this is true. Obviously, I've never been married, but I think the choices you make when you're young, you're very young, you really have to remake them as you go along. Or that at least was my experience. When I look back on why I decided to go into my particular line of work, which I did at a very young age, I just graduated from high school and I was not quite 18. Speaking of, you know, at a very young age, doing something that, you know, in theory at least, is supposed to last a lifetime. Why did I do it? I did it for a lot of reasons, and some of them were pretty good, and some of them were deeply stupid. One of them was very probably because, you remember when I said that all the men in my family were alcoholics? I thought, gee, I wonder how I can cover up my tracks. Here I come from this kind of sordid background. Neither of my parents finished high school. There was no such thing as GEDs back then. They both were in high school during the Depression. The law in Missouri at that point was at 16, you did not have to continue in school at all. Neither of them could, so they didn't. They never finished high school. In my family, and this is one odd effect of Al-Anon, of being children of alcoholics. We've got my siblings and I have degrees out the grommet, just an endless list of degrees and professional accomplishments. So I took some pains and partly chose my career because I wanted to, as part of the cover up, so you wouldn't guess that we had this sad secret at home. I talked my way into a scholarship at a local private high school in St. Louis, mainly because there was no way I could tell them that the reason why, even though both my parents were working, why we couldn't possibly afford private school tuition was my dad was a gambling addict. And we hemorrhaged, my family hemorrhaged money in a way that you couldn't possibly talk about. So that was one of the reasons, not a very worthy one, why I chose a profession I went into. Early in recovery, I gave a talk one day about, you know, it was career day. And so I was talking about all this. And like you do when you're early in recovery, I was took the occasion to say that, you know, yes, I came from a difficult family and blah, blah, blah. And one of the high school boys raises his hand and says, okay, now that you figured out that you're in your line of work because you came from an alcoholic family, since you're in recovery, do you have to stay? Do you have to keep doing that? And I thought, oh my God, I hadn't thought of that. So I had to do a lot of thinking. And what happened was over the years in recovery, I'm still in the same profession, but I think I got to the point where I did it a whole lot better. And I did it for much better reasons. The first year I was out working as a professional, I found that at the end of the day, a few drinks really, really helped because, see, I'd been playing God all day. And what they never tell you is that being God is really tiring, that you get so tired and so discouraged by the end of the day that you almost have to do something to compensate for that. So recovery has enabled me not to run around trying to fix people. It's gotten me to the point where I could run around and empathize with people, and I could listen to people, and I could say things like, yeah, I've been there too. I know what that's like. So anyway, what finally brought me to Al-Anon? I ended up being in the embarrassing position of having to tell my Al-Anon home group, which is in Tacoma, Washington. I go to it by Zoom. I had to tell them that I've been going to Al-Anon now for 25 years. And last Saturday, I asked someone to be my sponsor. Absolutely a true story. But even here, a power greater than myself, and God knows a power smarter than myself, helped me out a great deal. The person I asked to be my sponsor is Stephanie B. Stephanie lives in Texas. You may have heard her speak. I adore Stephanie. I'd known her for years when I asked her to be my sponsor. One of Stephanie's watchwords for me is GM. And when she says my name, it's four syllables. GM, ask for what you need. And she's very good at reminding me that that's what it's about. Like anybody who needs some Al-Anon meetings, I think people should guess what I need or leave me the hell alone. The idea that I should say out loud what I need, I'm sorry, I'll have to take points away on your score because I had to tell you. So anyway, what brought me to Al-Anon to stay? First, I was working with a spiritual community that I love very much. And guess what? I was asked to take it over by the guy ahead of me who was a really bad drunk. And how did I get the job? Well, they were kind of worried about him. So they said, why don't you kind of come in and be in the background? And after a while, things got worse. So they said, we're going to kick him upstairs. Why don't you take over? And I thought, goody, just what I've always wanted. I'm going to clean up an alcoholic's mess and everyone will admire me and see how fabulous I am that I can clean up an alcoholic's mess. And yeah, I I have some issues myself in that area, but I am in recovery, so that it won't be a problem. And so I did it for 3 or 4 years. One of the things that's true, and my home group makes a point of saying, we do not talk about the alcoholics in our lives as qualifiers. We are our qualifiers for Al-Anon. I qualify for Al-Anon because of the way that I have been affected and have failed to deal constructively with the effects on me if somebody else is drinking. Anyway, I finally got to the point where I realized that I couldn't fix it. An alcoholic with a good head of steam, and I should have known this, an alcoholic with a good head of steam can leave a toxic waste site wall to wall. And the idea that all I need is a broom and a dustpan and I can fix all this, that is insane. I also noticed after I'd been doing this job for a few years, trying to save all these people from the effects on them of an alcoholic leader, I was far too busy saving them to go to any meetings of any program. So I was maybe getting to one meeting a month. And once again, I got the idea, I don't think this is a good idea. That's on the professional side. On the personal side, what was going on and what made me know I needed Al-Anon was this. I only have one niece and one nephew. I had five siblings. Our brother died young of HIV. But I had five siblings. Only one of my siblings married and had children. Why? My parents made marrying and having children look astonishingly difficult. I think the rest of us just thought, nah, that's just too hard. Let's not do that. But my brother did marry and have children. So I had one niece and one nephew. And in time, when I was about 10 years in recovery, they started having children. And I discovered something. That and when I started working with church communities, I really like kids. And because I'm so immature, kids really like me. They think I'm another kid with an odd clan problem that makes me look funny. But I love hanging out with them. And somebody who observed me once interacting with some kids said, you know, you're remarkable. You listen to them. You don't tell them things. You just listen to them. Give them a place to talk. So I did that when my two grandnephews came along. And we just got to be very close. It turns out that kids really want somebody to listen to them. And I just did, and it really worked. And I was very close to them. One of the things to know about alcoholism is it really is a family illness. And as it says in the AA Big Book, alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. How cunning, baffling, and powerful is it? Well, it's cunning enough that it shifts shapes over the generations. Families come in generations. For a long time, I thought that I have a sober sister who I just found out today has COVID, but she's doing okay. She's been sober 25 years. I thought she and I were the last generation with any problems at all because we had both had alcoholism, both found recovery, successful long-term recovery, et cetera. And when I saw my niece and nephew coming up, I thought, well, they don't seem to have any trouble with alcohol or other drugs at all. Whoopee! You know, we've aged out of it or something. It took me a long time to realize that the alcoholism had shifted shape in the generation behind me, my niece, my nephew. It is an alcoholism. It's a very compulsive need to succeed. that's the form that the disease is taking in that generation. They're very, very driven people. And both of them married spouses who were considerably weaker than them psychologically. And I think what they inherited was not a need to misuse substances. It was a need to save people and to be really, really good at it. Okay, so far, so bad. But then the next generation, the grandnephews and grandnieces, at this point, there are five of them, three boys, two girls. The boys all have really serious learning disabilities, which are not uncommon in alcoholic families, by the way, among the men, among the males. The girls have food issues. No alcoholism, but you can see how the disease is changing shape over the generations to make sure that nobody's happy, that everybody's pretty miserable. And you can see the problem. My niece and my nephew have to succeed at all costs. They are very, very bright, very, very hardworking. My nephew is a millionaire. They've done very, very well. But of course, in the next generation, the form the alcoholism is taking is learning disabilities. And there came a point when I was about 20, 22 years in recovery, where my niece's husband was starting to physically discipline his two sons, my two grandnephews, and tell them they were stupid and lazy. And you know what it's like in families. Big secret. Nobody talks about it. Everybody knows about it. Everybody makes sure that when he's helping them with their homework, that you're in the next room in case it gets out of hand. He tells me privately that he's going to shift things around at his job so he can have even more time to help them with their homework. So what do? I love the two boys, so I spoke out loud. For what it's worth, I'm the scapegoat in the alcoholic family. That was my role. And scapegoats are canaries in the coal mine. We sing out when it gets really, really toxic. So I did. And two things happened. The first thing happened was I was told by that family that they never wanted to see me again. And I haven't seen them now in 17, 18 years. We'll probably never see them again. And that was really painful. That's what sent me to Al-Anon with my tail behind my legs, because when that happened, I thought, do I want to drink? No, I don't want to drink. Do I want to live? No, I don't want to live. I would just as soon not live much longer if I'm never going to see those boys again. They were very, very important to me. So I thought, where do you go when you belong to a family that has decided they never want to see you again and they're going to make it stick? If there's one thing that is true of my family, don't know if it's true of yours, if there's one trait that all of us have in common, it's stubbornness. You can see this in very elderly members of my family. You can see these in very little members of my family. Practically from the day we can talk, you know, our first word is not mommy or daddy, it's no. And after that, it's that's not fair. That's our watchword. So we play for keeps. One of the reasons why I began with the song from a Broadway musical is over the years, I taught in high school for a while, but I've always had a fascination with drama. Did some very modest acting, did some directing. And no wonder, when you grow up in a family like mine, drama is in your bones. It's in your genes. It's in your DNA. I don't feel like I ever should have had to audition for anything. Just, you know, here's a picture of my family. Don't you get it? So that was the first thing that happened, was I decided I have to go to Al-Anon, because I didn't know of any other place on earth where you can go when you have been told by a family member that you're never going to see some family members that you love with all your heart again. That, you know, when that all happened, I was about 60. I'm 76 now. I resigned myself that I'm never going to see the boys again. Where do you go when that is your truth? I didn't know of any place other than Al-Anon. So I went to Al-Anon to stay. I went to Al-Anon because I had to. I went to Al-Anon because there's no other place where you can say stuff like this. How many places on earth can you go to, like a good friend of mine in my Al-Anon home group, and say, yeah, my son's in jail. By the time he gets out, I'll be 86. Yeah. Anybody in Al-Anon is going to just nod and say, yeah. Details vary, but we know what it's like to have a son who's in jail for another 15, 20 years. We know what it's like to be told that you're never going to see these kids again. That's the bad news that came when I spoke out on behalf of my two grandnephews. The good news is this: because I had made this little stink about it, they had them tested. Older boy, dyslexia. Younger boy, ADHD. At the time, they were like 11 and 8. Since then, because they were tested, their dad stopped hitting them, and they started getting all the accommodations that kids who get tested for things like this can get these days. They both have degrees in aeronautical engineering from a university in Portland, Oregon. My grandnephew Patrick, not Patrick, my grandnephew Nicholas, his middle name is James, is beginning a career as an airline pilot. So if you ask me, won't regret, can't forget what I did for love. Was it worth it? Oh boy, it sure hurt, but good things happen. The boys got what they needed. And in Al-Anon, I got the ability to live with it and move on and say, okay, who else can I deal with? And if nothing else, I can be there for my friend Marcy, who's going to be 86 when her son gets out of jail. I want to talk a little bit about Tom W., the notorious, who asked me if I would sub for him tonight. I owe him a special debt. We're both members of Al-Anon as well as the other program. Tom did an Al-Anon save on me at a very, very tricky part of my recovery. You probably have gathered from what I said about my family interactions that, well, like I said, I'm a scapegoat. I find it very hard to bear really, really toxic situations. I have a limited ability to swallow it, to just pretend nothing is happening. My wonderful Al-Anon friend Jana has been using a term lately that makes a lot of sense to me. She says, she talks about the family trance. She says the family she grew up in, people were in a trance. But every now and then, a member or members will come out of the trance and they'll look around and say, what's going on here? What is this? And scapegoats, that's our role. The trance fails. We come out of the trance and say, what's going on here? When I got into recovery in Denver, I looked around with the place where I was working and the people I was living with then, and since I was no longer in an alcoholic trance, I also came out of the family or the group trance and started talking about what I saw. Just a warning, you might want to just keep this to your Al-Anon meeting. Because when you tell people who are still in the trance this, they invariably say, you're the problem. You're the crazy one. And that's exactly what happened to me. In very short order, the people in my life, the people who had power over me, both professionally and personally, said, you know, we liked you a whole lot better before recovery, because back then you used to pass out from time to time and your mouth would shut. And we're real tired of hearing about our defects of character. Now, it is also the case that I enjoyed taking other people's inventory more than my own, and that it took a while for that to get straightened out. Their say was, since we have found the new you, so disappointing. This actually happened. I got together with the regional boss at the old Denver airport, Stapleton, during this particular crisis. And he said, what we really want you to do is go away to a place for 6 months where they're going to finally get you on appropriate medications. And they're going to give you the kind of therapy where you will talk about your childhood conflicts and then be able to drink like a gentleman. And I said, I'm not sure about that. And he kept saying, no, this is the only thing that'll work. And I said, Bob, has it occurred to you that, you know, I'm in therapy, I go to meetings, I've got a sponsor, I work steps. What if, just wild and crazy notion, what if I just keep becoming more and more the person that I am, the person that I'm becoming? And he said, Jim, I don't think a merciful God would ever allow that to happen, that there would ever be an outcome so terrible as you becoming who you seem to be. Do you really need to snap out of it? So at that point, I thought, gee, I don't know about this pump me full of drugs and talk about my childhood conflicts business. It seems to me that that was kind of what I was doing before I found recovery, and it didn't work very well. So at that point, this is the late 1980s. I'm, you know, 5 or 6 years in the programs. I thought of Tom W. He and I had been in church school together. If you ask us what we remember of one another and we tell you, you need to know that we're both lying. Tom, because he was drunk practically nonstop during those years, and me, because I was so busy fixing people and he was so beyond fixing that I didn't pay much attention to him. But anyway, I heard Tom was in recovery, so I wrote him a letter and told him what I've just told you, that they want to institutionalize me, that they have completely rejected the new me, the recovered me. What should I do? And Tom wrote me back a letter in about 1988, the first line of which was, Dear Jim, no, you are not crazy. That's an Al-Anon save, my friends. He saved my life. Practically alone in the whole world, he said, no, you're on the path of sanity. You're getting somewhere, and you're not necessarily the crazy one. There are such things as crazy families. There are such things as crazy workplaces. No, you are not crazy. That's why I'm on the second floor now and Tom is up on the third floor. Although, of course, right now he's in El Cerrito, but later today, that's where we'll both end up. He saved my life. And that's an Al-Anon save. That's what we do when people show up at the meetings. While they might not put it this way, what somebody who comes to Al-Anon, and welcome to anybody who's new to Al-Anon here tonight, what they're basically saying is, am I the crazy one? Because everybody I know or all the members of my family are in this funny trance where they go around kind of glassy-eyed and I don't see any problems. And am I the crazy one? They're all telling me that I am. You can save somebody's life by telling them, no, you are not crazy. That's what Al-Anon offers to people. So that's what happened. I hooked into Al-Anon. I luckily found a wonderful, wonderful group in Tacoma. I am so glad about Zoom because for a lot of reasons I need not go into, I chose to move from Tacoma to Oakland 2 years ago, shortly after the pandemic began. And I didn't stop going to any of the meetings I went to in Tacoma. I just started adding some Zoom meetings in Oakland. So it's been wonderful. I've had too many losses in my life, and Zoom has made it possible for me not to lose some people who are very, very significant in my life. Something that I found maybe most essential in my Al-Anon life is the three meditation books. I heard my home group the other day, they're thinking of coming out with another one. Good for them. But anyway, I go through a 3-year cycle of One Day at a Time, which was the first, and Courage to Change, which was the second, and Hope for Today, which was the third. And what I read every day in those meditations book has so shaped my sense of Al-Anon, but also the way I live my life. One of the things I love about Al-Anon was I haven't been a real member of Al-Anon nearly as long as I've been a member of the other program, but I think I've gotten a lot farther at acknowledging and coming to terms with defects of character in Al-Anon. I don't know whether it's because in AA I get all competitive and masculine and try to conceal my failings, whereas most Al-Anon groups, like my home group, there are way more women than men, so it can feel like a more gentle environment. But I've come to terms with some defects of character. Now, whenever I have told Tom W. these defects of character, he rolls on the floor laughing. That it has taken me all these years to cop to these particular defects of character. Ready? The first one. Been going to my Al-Anon home group in Tacoma for a few years. It's an hour meeting. We do a lot of reading from the literature. I think that's very important because I think it keeps us focused and connected to Al-Anon. But we get to announcements and we get into this spirited discussion of what are we going to put in the baskets for the Christmas raffle that's coming up at District? Should it be like bubble bath? Should it be like chocolate? And remember, it's just an hour, and we already spent 10 to 15 minutes on the literature, and we're not going to break up into small groups until we figure out what's going in the frigging baskets. So I'm climbing the walls. I'm getting more and more agitated. And anyway, it's eventually, I don't know what we did, formed a committee probably. But on the way home, I thought, gee, all this time I've been going to this Al-Anon meeting, and one of the things that all my women friends admit freely is that they have problems with control. You don't suppose I have control issues too, do you? And at that point, I think I'd been in recovery about 30 years, and it was the first time it had crossed my mind that I might have control issues. For the very good reason that I'm extremely passive aggressive, so I didn't think I was controlling. Wrong. A couple of years later, same line of thought. my women friends, my Al-Anon group, were talking about perfectionism. And on the way home, I'm thinking, gee, all the women in the meeting seem to struggle with perfectionism. You don't suppose that I might have that same unhappy trait, do you? Well, let's see. Anytime I talk, this will happen later this evening. After we close the meeting and say the Serenity Prayer and go about our business, I will think back on any part of this share which I thought was not what it should have been, and I will cringe and I'll say, oh my God, I have to move again. What part of the country can I go to where they've never heard of Tom W. and, you know, I can live this all down? That is the story of my life. But see, I didn't think I was perfectionistic. I just thought I had high standards. Finally, another character defect that I came to own was people pleasing. And the reason I had so much difficulty realizing I was a people pleaser was it never occurred to me that I might be a really lousy people pleaser. That, in fact, my efforts to please people might fail signally and people would criticize me. It dawned on me at an Al-Anon meeting a few weeks ago that back in the late 80s, when I was in that very stormy period, that one of my bosses at that time, he was one of the most homophobic people I've ever met in my life. And so I thought, gee, is that why so many people thought so poorly of me? That his version of me was the prevailing version and he had certain preconceptions of his own. So I'm a people pleaser, but I'm just not very good at it. But anyway, I want to end by sharing with you one of my favorite meditations. And this also has to do with character defect or a defense mechanism or a strategy that I really used a lot all my life. And it was a revelation for me when I came across this in Courage to Change one day. I'll make it easy for you to remember this. It's Courage to Change. You all know Courage to Change. And it's the reading for December the 16th. Well, how can you remember December the 16th? Easy. It's Beethoven's birthday. So whenever you're trying to remember what was the date of that reading that Jim was so high on, just go, thanks, Al-Anon. Thanks, Al-Anon. And what the December the 16th reading, here's my cat, Sosa, that's her tail. December 16th, it starts, I was convinced that I had to take care of everything and everybody. I had no choice. Well, that's Al-Anon in 25 words or less. I was convinced that I had to take care of everything and everybody. And I had no choice. This is divinely ordained. That's my purpose in life. But with the help of Al-Anon, I have learned that while I do have responsibilities, I wanted to take care of everybody, but I didn't want any responsibility, which the results were not good of trying to combine those. I have learned that while I do have responsibilities, there are also many things I do not have to do. And boy, the older I get, the more it makes me happy to be told, you don't have to do that anymore. Like, you don't have to get another colonoscopy. You've had enough. It's there's nothing we don't know about that part of you. Just a bit of wisdom, though, and this is recovery speaking to you now. Do not piss off your proctologist. I don't think I need to spell that out. This is actually a lively truth for me. I don't like my proctologist one bit, and I could give you a long list of the reasons why I don't like him. But am I going to tell him all the things that I don't like about him? I've been in Al-Anon long enough that I thought, no, do not piss off your proctologist. Anyway, here's a list of things I do not have to do. There's seven of them, but the first one is the one that I most relate to, the one that absolutely blew me away. I don't have to understand everything. Some things are not my business. Well, there's a shocker. I thought everything was my business. And others will simply never make sense to me. One of my deepest beliefs is that if I just try hard enough, I'll be able to understand. I'll be able to, things will finally make sense if I just know what's going on behind the scenes. Well, what gave me this idea? Alcoholic family. I wasn't told what was really going on. I was perceptive enough to sense there is a story going on. There's something going on behind the scenes here, and I don't know what it is. But if I can just figure it out, then I'll be safe. It goes practically without saying that by the time I was 13 years old, I had read all the Sherlock Holmes stories. I read one, I don't know, at some age or other, and I couldn't stop. I'm a little compulsive. And so I read all of them. I mean, there's a finite number of Sherlock Holmes stories by Arthur Conan Doyle. And when you've read them all, you're done. There aren't any more. And I couldn't stop. I had to keep reading because I thought these stories are wonderful. At the end, Sherlock Holmes, like Adrian Monk, says, here's what happened. Here's what's really going on. I really believe that knowledge is power. It isn't. It's just knowledge. And in fact, knowledge can leave you sadder and more frightened than you were before you knew it. So that was a big help to me to find out that I didn't have to figure anything else out. What do I do instead of figuring stuff out? Well, this is one of the benefits of aging too. When I was younger, I did what a lot of us do when we're younger, and I tried to fix things and fix people. Now I'm moving towards what spiritual writers call contemplation. And there are books on contemplation, and there are tapes and things and practices and that can make it sound very, very complicated and very difficult. I'm too lazy to do all that stuff. But so I've decided that for me, what contemplation is just looking on something or someone with love. That's it. Just to look on somebody and say, I just love you the way you are. I mentioned that I did what we all do at 6 years. I went back to school, got a certificate. And for a while, after I got certified, in the state of Washington, I was certified. I was approved that I could diagnose you. And my diagnosis was admissible in court. If I said you were an alcoholic and wrote that up and handed it in, the court would accept that as the truth. Of course, I loved that. I loved having the last word on people. Well, I'm glad I've left that way behind. It's a much better place to be to say, I see you. I see your flaws just like I see mine. I see your good points. But mostly all I want to do is we don't have to talk. We don't have to do anything. I don't have to assess you. I don't have to fix you. I just have to love you. I just have to, and a big part of loving is gratitude. I'm just so glad that here you are, here I am, here we are. Since I moved to Oakland a couple of years ago, none of this was planned. My whole life wasn't really planned. I made plans and then something completely different happened and it was always better. So what the hell? But I've been doing a lot of thinking and a lot of writing, and I've entered a more contemplative phase. I'm not nearly as active in church circles as I once was. Tom is back to traveling all over everywhere. That's why he's in El Cerrito tonight. And that's why I'm in my bedroom with my cat. Because I don't feel like traveling much anymore. But I've done a lot of thinking and I've done some writing and I continue to write about how do we get through what we've gotten through in the last 2 years. And I think it all started with, we thought, well, it's going to be bad for a while, but then that'll stop and everything will be fine again. And that's not what has happened. And it seems like that's not what is going to happen. I sponsor a guy, wonderful guy, who is a retired police officer. He called me the other day, given recent events, he was just beside himself. What I said to my friend was, there are some big, terrible things going on in the world. But I think what we need to do is find some small, really good things in the world. But we need to find them every single day. It really is a one day at a time program. But if today I can, even for a few minutes, even for a little while, I can get to that place of contemplation and of love, I think I'll be okay. When I celebrated my 50th belly button birthday, I went out to eat with my sponsor, my long-term sponsor. She's still my sponsor. And we were at a restaurant in Seattle. And I had a great big glass of iced tea. I really like iced tea. And I was wearing light-colored pants. And you guessed it, in the course of the meal, I knocked the iced tea over. And then she and I went to a meeting, and I had a great big wet spot on the front of my pants. I can think of that as a blessing, because I'm almost certain that if I hadn't found recovery, these 12 steps, Al-Anon, I wouldn't have made 50. So the reason we were celebrating and the reason I got to go to a big public event with a big wet spot on the front of my pants was because I found you all. And I'm really grateful for that. So thank you for listening.